This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Water loss on land adds to rising seas. Global drying with gravity satellite expert Jay Famiglietti. Is this planet actually a living cooperative? Explore with science journalist Ferris Jaber. Expect abrupt shifts in big systems from ocean currents to ice. New science led by Sjoerd Terpstra. Three interviews. Let's get busy. We know why sea levels are rising around the world. Hotter oceans mean thermal expansion, and warmer pools are dumping extra water from melting glaciers. Except, now we find out there is a third source of new water into the sea, and it's bigger than each of those. From deep underground to lakes, human actions are pushing Earth's land water into decline. Think what that means for crops, drinking water, and all living things. The paper published July 24th in Science Advances is titled Unprecedented Continental Drying, Shrinking Freshwater Availability, and Increasing Land Contributions to Sea Level Rise. We reached co-author Dr. James J. Famiglietti. He is the former director of the Global Institute for Water Security at the University of Saskatchewan and previous senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. From California, J. Famiglietti, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me.
We all heard that wet places get wetter and dry get drier as the world warms, but we pictured some kind of balance. How did your team discover land water sources are actually decreasing?
We used 22 years of satellite data from the NASA GRACE, which stands for Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment Missions. GRACE allows us to track how water storage on the continents and in the ocean and on the ice sheets varies over time. And because we've been monitoring it for over two decades with these satellites, we can see the long-term trends. And that allowed us to see this very startling picture of an increasing amount of continental drying. You mentioned the wet areas getting wetter and the dry areas getting drier. And that's only partially true now. At high latitudes, which used to be under the wet areas get wetter umbrella, we found that those places are melting and permafrost is thawing and they too are getting drier.
When you and I talked in 2014, you told us about declining groundwater under the big food-producing state of California. Did last year's atmospheric rivers replenish groundwater supplies there? What is the state of California's water supplies 10 years later?
It's about 10 years worse. We wrote a paper at the end of 2022 that showed that groundwater levels were declining at an accelerating pace rather than slowing down, which one might expect in response to the passage of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. The long-term picture in California and in a lot of our food-producing regions is that we use so much water that those regions, those aquifers that underlie those regions, will never be replenished. They get a little replenishment during those wet periods, but that will never compensate for the continued groundwater use during the dry periods.
At least a billion people depend on pumping groundwater, especially as drought becomes more common. On the North Indian Plains, farmers are drilling 100 feet, 30 meters to get water and having to go deeper. How serious is the human role in draining water that accumulated over millennia below ground?
I think that it's poorly appreciated how much a role humans are playing in the continental drying that we report on in the paper. And specifically, I'm talking about groundwater depletion. That's a human decision. It's one that we could cut back on. In California, I live in Arizona now. You know, when I used to live in Saskatchewan, around the world, we are making a decision to pump far more groundwater than is available to us on an annual renewable basis, and it's led to this huge decline that we reported in the paper. So the humans are having an undeniable role and one that we could actually choose to scale back on.
Your study raises another red flag. For years, scientists predicted the far north forests in Canada and Russia would get wetter as the Earth heats up, and you mentioned that. What did you find? I mean, why is this not going to happen?
So last time we wrote a big paper like this one, which was 2018, we had analyzed data, say, from 2002 to 2016. And we did show in those papers that the high-latitude areas were getting wetter and the mid-latitudes were getting drier, just as predicted by the climate models that are used around the world. In this paper, we had an additional 10 years or so of data, and we found that things have really changed, especially over the last decade, and especially at high latitudes. Those are regions that are warming at about four times the global rate, and that's leading directly to snow and ice melt and permafrost thaw. And those phenomena are not really well represented in the climate model. So it's not a surprise to me that the models don't predict it, because the processes are not embedded in the models. The pace of the ice and snow melt and the thawing of the permafrost and its pathway to the ocean to drive sea level rise are not well represented in our models.
Well, here's something that was giving me mental exclamation marks in my brain as I was reading your new paper. Talk to us about the rapid expansion of dry areas and the emergence of mega drying regions.
So again, when we published our last big papers on this topic, and we had a couple of big ones in 2018 and 2016, when we have constructed what we call our global trend map, this global picture of the places that are getting wetter and getting drier, in the places that were getting drier, it was more distinct hotspots and not necessarily interconnected. Over the last 10 years or so, and I keep mentioning this 10-year inflection point around 2014, which was the timing of the biggest El Nino ever recorded. And right about that time then, we start seeing a rapid increase in the areas around the world that are experiencing extreme drying, more frequent drought. And sort of a complementary impact, we see less of the world getting wetter. So what we're seeing is that the rate of drying is increasing. The area that's experiencing drying and extreme drying is increasing at about two times the size of California each year. And that's been compensated for by the shrinking of the areas that are getting wetter. That also leads then to the connection on a map of the previously very distinct hotspots. And so now when you look between the hotspots, you see a lot more drying. For example, it might be in the United States, California, and the Ogallala Aquifer. And they would have really popped out on a map before. Now, if you look at that global map, you see just a mass of drying across the southwestern U.S., into Mexico, down into Central America, and up even into the northwestern U.S. And so that's led to what we call these mega drying regions. That was an effort on my part to really try to communicate the expanse of the drying and how much it's changed over the last decade.
And the new paper in Science Advances maps out four huge regions of land water loss. The one that caught my eye was in Asia. Could you describe sort of what that mega region includes?
Well, that's a huge region. I mean, it basically goes from northern Africa to northern Europe and from western Europe all the way across to Southeast Asia. And it, I think, underscores the expansion of these drying regions from, again, just a small collection of hotspots to a massively interconnected drying landscape. It's basically first steps towards land degradation and desertification. So we really need to be paying attention to this and responding to it at a global scale.
Why didn't I find mega drying in the southern hemisphere, like Australia?
That's a good question. And so we are trying to figure that out. And in the paper, we actually talk about an oscillation, a switch from drying happening mostly in the southern hemisphere to drying happening mostly in the northern hemisphere. So there could be a fundamental change in the climate system, a new oscillation that we point to in the paper, and that is something we're working on right now.
We also have listeners in the UK and Europe. Both have been drier than normal over the past few years, especially Britain. It's remarkable what's happened there this year. And that's a factor in the wildfires there. What did you find out about water loss in Europe, Jay?
Again, relative to these earlier papers that I keep mentioning, we found that the occurrence of drought, especially over the last 10 years in Europe, has really sort of really hit Europe quite hard and attached it to this mega region. And that's one of the main reasons for the expansion compared to previous papers was what's been happening in Europe. And of course, when you go there, I was just out there in Stockholm and I've done a lot of work in Germany. And, it's clear. It's not just something that we're seeing from satellites. It's being experienced, of course, quite significantly on the ground.
Well, let's picture the process, perhaps an agribusiness operation irrigating vast fields with water pumped from underground. So that water evaporates up into the sky and somehow it adds to sea level rise. Why doesn't it just fall again as rain on land?
So there's two things that are happening. So when we pump water out of the ground, what really happens? Well, some of it is embedded in the plant. Some of it infiltrates back down into the ground. A lot of it runs off into rivers and streams that ultimately drain into the ocean. And yes, there's an increase in evaporation. The issue with evaporation in the atmosphere is that the atmosphere doesn't actually store a tremendous amount of water. So it might rain out on land, but ultimately it ends up collecting in the ocean. So again, it gets points to the lack of storage capacity in the atmosphere and the ocean being this ultimate collector for additional water in the water cycle.
Okay, so after a steady diet of ice walls crashing into the sea in Greenland and Antarctica, it's a shock to find even more sea level rise comes from land water loss. If that's true, is water storage in lakes and reservoirs also decreasing?
Yes, it is. The thing about water storage in reservoirs is that it's another human decision, and it's managed by humans, but it certainly fluctuates with how the climate fluctuates. I guess the difference I like to say is one of the big differences between surface water and groundwater is that surface waters in our rivers and our lakes and certain our reservoirs fluctuates. It goes up and down. There's wet periods. There's dry periods. We've got a human management aspect to it. But for the most part, with groundwater, the groundwater just disappears. We use so much of it that we're not replacing it with what happens on the surface.
Your paper does not contain the words peak water, but groundwater and reservoirs can run out. Iran just ran dry. Cities in many parts of the world approached 0 day or had to truck in water. What do you think, Jay? Is peak water a valid worry, or is it too soon for that?
I hesitate to invoke the term peak water because it implies that we know how much groundwater we have, and we actually don't, and that's kind of a startling fact. We know that, of course, we're having huge impacts on the landscape through groundwater depletion. We've got subsidence of the ground surface. We've got falling water tables, degrading water quality, impacts on biodiversity, depleting rivers. So the impacts are all negative. But we don't actually know how much water we have, and that's a challenge. So I tend to stay away from the term peak water, but I will say that there's been a number of studies that have shown that we are well past using easily accessible groundwater.
Why does your team exclude Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets from your definition of continental drying?
That's more a sea level construct. The sea level community likes to split those off, and because they're so huge, because they're such major contributors to sea level rise, also because they're well measured not only by the GRACE satellites but by other satellites. So it really sort of helps us fit into the well established sea level change studies that are embedded in the global change community.
Well, would it be true to say this generation is burning through water essential for life that cannot be replaced? I mean, is this another generational issue where humans are kind of using up the future?
Certainly it is with respect to groundwater. Groundwater is an intergenerational resource. It took, you know, tens of thousands and more years to accumulate that water in the world's aquifers, and in most cases around the world, we're burning through it in about a century. We are putting future generations and current generations at risk, and that's an important message for people to really understand. We need to be thinking about, in every country around the world, how we can sustain this groundwater for future generations, and it is particularly important in the drying regions of the world where, in my opinion, you know, especially in the already arid regions that are getting drier, in my opinion, groundwater is the most precious natural resource. And you're right, we're burning through it at far too rapid a clip.
Your paper does end with a call to action. Your team attempts to separate that action from the slower moving climate change to the active problem of continental drying. How would that work? And on a practical level, Jay, what can be done better?
Around the world, I think that every country and states and provinces within countries around the world really need to think carefully about their groundwater management. In many places around the world, the monitoring and the management of groundwater is weak and in some cases non-existent. And so that has to change. At the global scale, it's really, really important that we elevate water in the global change discussions that are had by that are held by the UN, for example, the COP meetings that happen every year, the Bonn Climate Conference that happens every year. There's Climate Week in New York that's happening in a couple of weeks. We need to elevate the discussion of water and the rapidly changing water availability, rapidly increasing water security, and all the issues that are associated with it to the level of carbon dioxide. That's what I would like to see happen, and that's one thing that I'm working hard to do.
Yes, you've been working, studying hidden water reserves for a long time. What are you working on next, and where do you see the next frontier?
That's an excellent question, because I feel like with this paper, I've really sort of made the transition to the action phase of my career. Scientifically, we're always trying to improve our methods. We're trying to bring together more and more satellites. There's higher resolution satellites now available through the private sector. So we're trying to combine those things also with machine learning and AI to do the best job we possibly can. So we're always working on that. We're always working on improving our resolution in space and time so that we can get down to the scale, say a 1 kilometer scale, at which water management decisions are made around the world. We are always working very carefully and very hard with stakeholders, with our departments of water resources, whether I've lived both in California and Arizona. So trying to do a lot locally and then globally, again, really turning my attention to and trying to build community and connect communities that are trying to elevate the awareness of water and elevate its stature within these global climate discussions.
From Arizona, we've been speaking with Dr. Jay Famiglietti. And Jay helped publish a revealing new study titled Unprecedented Continental Drying, Shrinking Freshwater Availability, and Increasing Land Contributions to Sea Level Rise. You can find links, notes, and quotes in my show blog every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Jay, thank you so much for sharing time with our listeners.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Radio EcoShock.
Living things can be found deep in the rock and floating high in the atmosphere. As life and this planet blend together, does a new level of being emerge? What or who is Gaia? All this is professionally explored by Ferris Jaber in his book Becoming Earth, A Journey Through the Hidden Wonders That Bring Our Planet to Life. Ferris publishes articles with The New Yorker, The Atlantic, National Geographic, and Scientific American. He has received fellowships from major American universities. From Portland, Oregon, Ferris Jaber, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's first travel to the places we don't go, and then we will tackle the bigger picture of Gaia. How can anything live deep underground in the rock and never see sunlight or water from the clouds?
Yeah, it's truly astonishing just how much life is living very deep within the rocky crust of the planet. Just a few decades ago, scientists didn't really think anything lived down there, and it now turns out that perhaps the majority of microbes, of microorganisms on the planet, may live within the planet's rocky crust. And it turns out that this crust is not just solid rock. It's actually perfused with all kinds of fissures and cracks that are full of water. And in general, wherever you find water, you find life. Now, because these microbes are cut off from sunlight and from easy access to oxygen, they've had to find different ways of making energy and sustaining themselves. So they've learned to essentially breathe and eat the rocks and metals and minerals around them.
A few years ago, we talked with microbiologist David Thaler. He said, not only do we not have any map or catalog of microscopic life, but such a project is impossible because new organisms can appear in a day among billions of species. So Gaia inventor James Lovelock would ask, what is the purpose of this underground life? How does it tie into the overall project? Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I think one thing that's particularly interesting about these so-called intraterrestrial microbes is that they may be some of the living microbes today that are most similar to what life looked like billions of years ago. You know, when single-celled organisms first emerged billions of years ago, they may have emerged in parallel in multiple places on the planet. So they may have started out in the deep crust, in the deep ocean, perhaps on the surface. And they may have had very unusual ways of making a living and getting energy that is, you know, not as common today. So the, you know, the microbes that we're most familiar with may not be the ones that most closely resemble what the earliest life forms looked like. So I think that these microbes that live really far away from us are in some ways a window into the past. They're a way for us to time travel and see what life might have been like a long time ago when the Earth was very different from today.
And some people think, well, maybe the first life traveled to Earth buried in an asteroid. What do you think? Is there any science around this, or is it just an idea?
It seems to have sort of remained mostly an idea. You know, it's certainly not entirely implausible. We know that sometimes really massive rocks enter our planet's atmosphere, and they leave giant chunks, you know, meteorites the size of boulders on the surface. So if something that large can survive the journey and there is life embedded within it, you know, that is a possibility. But there's no really clear, compelling evidence that that is the case, that that is how life first emerged here. So I think most scientists don't really put that much stock in that notion.
Well, going to the other extreme, when we look up in the sky, we don't usually think there's a lot of living things up there, but there are. And along those lines, scientists discovered trees in the Amazon can stimulate their own weather. And you wrote about this. Amazon rainforests even influence weather in the Northern Hemisphere. Could you talk about how that might work?
Yeah, so the Amazon rainforest generates about half of the rain that falls on its canopy each year. And it really involves all of the life in the forest. So the trees and plants are collectively pulling huge volumes of water from the soil with their roots and then releasing what they don't use to the atmosphere. So saturating the air with huge volumes of water vapor. And at the same time, the forest is breathing out this potpourri of tiny biological particles, things like microbes and pollen grains and fungal spores. And the water vapor combines and condenses on all of those little particles, which is how clouds form. So the life being, you know, breathed out of the forest combined with all the water vapor dramatically accelerates cloud formation in the rain cycle. And this generates a massive flying river of precipitation that travels throughout South America And then because the atmosphere is one big entity and it's all interconnected, what happens over one continent affects what's happening elsewhere in the world. So this massive flying river generated by the Amazon is having these ripple effects, these teleconnections through the atmosphere, and is influencing precipitation as far away as Canada and the Pacific Northwest.
And I really enjoyed in your book the description of going up the Measuring Tower, the highest human-made structure in South America. Why is it there, and what was it like?
Yes, the Amazon Tall Tower Observatory is in the heart of the Amazon rainforest in a protected area, and scientists come from all over the world to climb it and to study the relationship between the atmosphere and the forest. And it's basically like a giant utility tower, a massive steel staircase in the middle of the rainforest. And so you have to be harnessed onto it, onto the railing as you climb up, just in case you slip through one of the many gaps. And when you make it to the top, which takes a few hours of climbing, you are literally halfway between the treetops, the canopy, and the clouds. And you can see this process of the Amazon making its own rain and clouds happen. You can see the mist coming off of the forest, rising up, forming the clouds, and then falling back down again as rain. And it's a really interesting place to build a research station because it's protected. The air is a lot cleaner and more pure than in other parts of the world. And so you can really see, you know, what the atmosphere is like just in relationship to the forest as opposed to industry.
I guess you couldn't go up there in high wind situations.
No, and you have to be careful about the weather and storms. You know, you don't want to be on this giant lightning rod in the middle of a thunderstorm. So if it does start to get too rainy and stormy, you need to hike back down really quickly.
It's so weird to think the upper air is alive with living things that can travel and maybe reproduce far away. How would you describe life in the atmosphere?
Yeah, I think of it as heaven's microbiome. You know, we know that we and all complex living creatures are ecosystems. We're walking ecosystems. We have microorganisms in and on and around us all the time. And the same is really true of all bodies, all ecosystems throughout our planet. We used to think that there wasn't any life up in the clouds, but it turns out that microbes are continually being whisked off of the land and sea and up into the air because they are so tiny and essentially weightless. And once they get up there, they can actually hang around and form communities for weeks to months, even sometimes eating or reproducing within the clouds and then returning to the surface in precipitation, in rain and snow and hail. So scientists have found microbes inside hailstones and snow crystals and rain all over the world. And some of these microbes are actually actively changing the weather. There's a particular bacterium that has proteins on its surface that actually encourage liquid water molecules to freeze into a solid ice crystal. So it can start these chain reactions of crystallization within rain clouds. And when it does that, it makes the clouds much larger and heavier much really quickly, and that encourages them to fall as rain, as precipitation. So it actually helps the microbes return to the surface. So they've potentially evolved these strategies to, deal with constantly being whisked up into the atmosphere and then getting back down to the ground, and in the process are changing the meteorology of the whole planet.
Well, let's approach this concept of Gaia. Does that name point to a super system, a new type of being, or how do you see it?
Well, when Lovelock initially was writing about Gaia in the 70s and 80s, he did often call it a being. He would sometimes call it a superorganism. But over time, James Lovelock and his many collaborators, including the American biologist Lynn Margulis, they refined their ideas. They clarified what they were talking about. And the modern evolution is to think of Earth as an interconnected living system. It's not a superorganism. It's actually the largest known living system. It's one big interconnected system in which all the animate and inanimate parts are working in concert. And it is analogous to you know, smaller but complex living entities like ourselves, we also are these jumbles of the animate and the inanimate. You know, most of our bodies is actually inanimate water and mineral and such, and then we only have so many actual living cells and tissues, but it all works together as one big system. So that's how I've really come to think of Earth, is that, you know, it's a vast, interconnected living system. It's really life on the scale of a planet. You know, that's what it looks like when a whole planet comes to life.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex continues with Ferris Jaber, author of Becoming Earth.
Back in 2009, I spoke with Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington. He criticized the Gaia concept, publishing a counter theory called the Medea hypothesis. Ward would probably accept that a new overarching operating system, if you will, has appeared on Earth, but not that it has any purpose. Do you need to have a purpose in order to have Gaia?
I don't think so, and I think that's one of the things that's been clarified over time, is that in the beginning, Lovelock put too much purpose, too much agency, too much teleology into Gaia, and over time realized that that was not necessary. You know, that's not really how evolution works. We don't have to be working towards some sort of explicit goal. It's more of an emergent phenomenon. You know, there are certain physical and chemical conditions in place. Certain things are possible, certain things happen, and this results in astonishing complexity and beauty, but there isn't necessarily some explicit goal or driving purpose behind it all.
Well, before speaking to you, I reread my copy of James Lovelock's original 1979 book, Gaia, A New Look at Life on Earth. Lovelock criticizes environmentalists at the time for their focus on their own industrial societies. He suggested the real places where Earth's environment pivots away from current life will be found in marshes and coastal shelves, as well as underreported changes in the tropics. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, the latest science that I'm finding says that's probably true. That is where the action's taking place.
Yeah, you know, Lovelock was such an interesting character. He was a real maverick scientist, and he published a lot of different views over his lifetime, some of which contradicted each other. You know, his first book on Gaia was just his first, and he ended up publishing a whole series, and he, you know, had this real evolution of thought. And when it comes to his opinions on environmentalism and industry, there's definitely some contradictions, you know, embedded in there and in the overall literature. But I think on the whole, we see that he absolutely accepted the reality of climate change, that, you know, the fossil fuel industry was what was driving climate change. And he was really interested in this idea of, you know, how can we sort of apply the concepts of biology and medicine to the planet as a whole and think about how to help the planet heal, how to help the planet recover from this shock, this crisis that we had forced it into. And I do think there's still something useful about that, because I do think that, you know, the planet is this immense living being, and we have pushed it into this crisis state, and it has recovered from such crises many times in the past, but it always takes a really long time to do so, and in the process, many, many species can go extinct, and obviously that is not something that is compatible with modern human civilization. So our task right now is trying to figure out how to help our planet recover much more quickly and much more safely, so that it does not enter one of these, you know, extremely unstable recovery periods that we probably will not survive.
Do you have any suggestions on how to bring the public realization that we are a part of life, not separate, that we are tiny parts of a planetary thing?
Well, that's really, you know, one of the major tasks that my book is engaged with, and I hope that that kind of science writing can help people understand. You know, one of the most personal ways in which I engage with this has been through my garden. Gardening became really important to me in the course of writing this book. And when I'm out there, I can really feel a visceral connection to the planet in a way I couldn't before. I think it really forces you to slow down and pay attention and really, you know, observe the minutiae of a single leaf or blade of grass or these tiny micro communities and ecosystems that really exist all around us.
Ferris, what are you watching and working on these days?
I have been working on a series of climate change articles for the New York Times Magazine, where I'm a contributing writer. I published one earlier this year in which I went to Australia to spend some time with scientists who are looking at changing the weather above the Great Barrier Reef as a way to potentially help the corals endure the warming and bleaching that they've been suffering from. So these scientists are trying to generate fog and brighten clouds to reflect more light and heat and cool down the water for the corals. And then more recently, I've been looking into the issue of ocean acidification and carbon dioxide removal and, you know, the latest thinking from the scientific community on these subjects.
And so how do our listeners follow your work?
My website is just my name, ferrisjaber.com, and I list all my articles there, and they can look out for my work in the New York Times Magazine. And I'm also on social media. I'm active on Instagram and Blue Sky under my name as well.
And Jaber is spelled J-A-B-R, so it's ferrisjaber.com. From Portland, we've been speaking with author and science journalist Ferris Jaber. You can check out his book, Becoming Earth, A Journey Through the Hidden Wonders That Bring Our Planet to Life. And you can also find further discussion in my own weekly blog at ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
Most of us know someone who reached a breaking point. They may go through an abrupt change of circumstances. Natural systems like ocean currents and polar ice can also shift quickly, with consequences around the world. We would like to anticipate fast changes, but early climate models could not predict shifts taking place in less than a decade. Multiple climate systems could undergo abrupt shifts. That comes from a new study using 57 worldwide climate models in a warming world. The lead author is Sjoerd Tepstra, a PhD candidate at the Institute for Marine and Atmospheric Research. That's at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. The open access article was published in AGU Advances, June 23, 2025. From Utrecht, Sjoerd Tepstra, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
So abrupt shifts in the world around us sound pretty scary. How did you and your colleagues define abrupt shifts?
Yeah, so abrupt shifts are indeed quite high impact events. They denote big changes in subsystems of the climate. And how we defined it is as a sudden and large change that is substantially faster than how a system normally changes. So if you look, for example, at Arctic sea ice, with climate change, you expect a decline in the sea ice cover. And that's actually also what we see. And this we would call a relative gradual decline. However, if it undergoes an abrupt shift, you expect that a very large part of the sea ice cover will disappear within a few years or up to a decade. So these are really like high impact, large changes that reorganizes the system and brings it into a new state.
We've had expert guests on this program in the past say models were unable to predict large scale but short time duration events like the disappearance of the sea ice in 2007 in the Arctic. How did your group overcome that barrier?
Yeah, indeed. It can sometimes be difficult to detect these events in climate models. There are sort of two parts to this answer. So some of the changes we've seen in parts of the climate and also in sea ice, where we had a sharp decline in some years, were not always as persistent. So sometimes they partially at least recover. And we really look at abrupt shifts that are persistent. So what this means is that after a decade or actually multiple decades, we would still find the system in this like new state. That's one part. And the other part is that many of these climate models over the decades have been improved. New processes have been added. They've got better input data. So over time, they are better able to capture these phenomena.
Talk to us about the range and rate of warming you considered in this study. Was it as fast as today, and did you consider even greater warming that might come in coming decades?
Yeah, we used a special experiment. So the model set that we're using are the so-called CMIP-6 models. And these are the latest generation, like state-of-the-art climate models that incorporate as many processes as possible. And these are also used to inform the big IPCC report, so the big climate report. And they all do the same experiment. And one of them is experiments where the CO2 levels are increased every year by 1%, starting from pre-industrial. So what this means, they start with climate around, let's say, the end of the 19th century, and then quite aggressively increase the CO2, and they do this for 150 years. Now, what this means with this 1% is actually you force it a lot. So after roughly 50 to 60 years, you're already at the CO2 levels we are experiencing now. And what this allows us to do is to look at a wide range of warming in these models to really capture as much of the future climate as possible.
Now, there was a 2021 IPCC chapter titled Weather and Climate Extreme Events in a Changing Climate, and that was in the sixth assessment report of the IPCC. Now, did your work change or build on that?
Partially. I think it's also partially adjacent to this work. So this chapter is really about extreme events, and extreme events are also quite big abrupt changes. But the big difference is that they're often short-lived. So, for example, if you look at wildfires or at droughts or at extreme rainfall, the frequency of these events may increase, but there's no like really a different persistent state that you achieve. But we really look at if a whole system really changes. So, for example, if part of ocean circulation suddenly stops, or if a big part of the sea ice suddenly disappears. Interestingly, though, is that also in the next IPCC report, there will be a more specialized chapter that will also more explicitly talk about these high-impact, persistent uplift shifts.
We should clear up short any confusion between tipping points, which are pretty widely known, and the abrupt shifts that you were talking about. What are the similarities and differences here?
Yeah, they're indeed quite confusing concepts because they're actually quite highly related. So abrupt shifts, as I said earlier already, is a real fast and sudden change in the system. But that's all. That's all the requirements there are. You have also systems, they are called tipping elements, that can undergo tipping. And these are more systematic, qualitative changes in the system. And what happens if they reach their tipping point? There is sort of a critical threshold where suddenly the system reorganizes itself. So, for example, if you have global warming as sort of a forcing of a system, if you reach a certain level of it, you suddenly change the system. So it's really a short tipping period. In addition to that, we have some type of irreversibility when a system undergoes tipping. And what this means is once you're past this point of no return, past this tipping point, you cannot really bring the system back to where you wanted it to be beforehand. So if we take, again, the sea ice analogy, if it would undergo a tipping point and it would fully melt, you cannot just reduce the global temperature to the levels before this tipping point because the ice would not regrow yet because there is not enough freezing capability. So we really need to bring the whole climate back way more in the past to actually recover many of these systems. And that makes it so difficult to deal with them once you pass this point of no return. And often when they do tip, they can undergo an abrupt shift. So often they change quite abruptly, but it's not necessary.
What subsystems did you investigate? Could you just give us a quick list?
Yes, we focused on a few different systems. One are the sea ice systems in the Arctic and in the Southern Ocean. We also looked on the land at the rainforest in the Amazon and the boreal forest. We furthermore, we looked at permafrost, so permanently frozen ground in the Northern Hemisphere. And we focused on some part of the ocean circulation, which is the North Atlantic Subpolar Gyre.
Before we dive into specific cases, in a couple of places in your new paper, it appears that two or more abrupt shifts could develop at the same time. We could get a big shock. Short, is that likely, and is combined system change more likely as the planet warms?
Yeah, it could indeed be possible that multiple systems undergo such an abrupt shift, either simultaneously or one after another. We do find in quite some model simulations that this does occur. It's not really clear how independent they are, if they are independent of each other or if one can cause another. This is still a relatively new area and something we're actively working on to really see, like, for example, if part of the ocean circulation would abruptly stop, what would then the effect be on precipitation over the rainforest? Or what would the effect be on the sea ice? This is still a very active area of research, but it is possible that multiple of events would occur in one situation.
We expected slow, orderly warming, just going up on a ramp. Most of the charts showed a ramp, but climate change may change in jumps. Does the rate of warming affect appearance of abrupt shifts?
Yeah, so what we do see in our results is that models that warm faster have more abrupt shifts. Partially this is due to the fact that our model simulations are all the same length of 150 years, and some models in that time period warm more than others, which means that if you reach higher temperatures in these models, more of the subsystems are at risk for abrupt shifts. However, it is unclear if there is really some type of instability caused by higher rates of warming. It could be that if you warm something faster, the system becomes more unstable, but we did not find explicit evidence of that, and that would really need more research.
Well, let's look at a couple of systems that you did analyze. One is the North Atlantic Gyre of the Atlantic Ocean. Is that the same as the Gulf Stream or AMOC, and what did you find?
The North Atlantic Superpolar Gyre is part of the AMOC, but we do see them partially as different systems. So this AMOC is, let's say, the conveyor belt of the Atlantic Ocean. It brings warm surface water towards the north, and northern Atlantic, it actually sinks because it's quite dense water, and then at death, it will return as cold water to the south. So it's this big northward heat transport that dictates much of the climate in the northern hemisphere, especially around Europe. Now, the North Atlantic Subpolar Gyre is one of these locations where this AMOC water sinks to the bottom. Now, what happens with climate change is that this AMOC weakens, so the amount of sinking reduces and this whole system starts to slow down. And what we now find is that the Subpolar Gyre, as one of these locations of sinking, might actually abruptly stop with the sinking or the convection of this water. Even if this would occur, part of the AMOC might still flow. So they're partially different systems, but they're highly connected. And what we did find in the Subpolar Gyre is that in a third of the models, we find indications of stop of convection, so stop of this circulation, and it occurs between around half a degree Celsius to 2 degrees Celsius of global warming. So it is quite a wide range, but it's definitely slightly on the lower end of some of the expected temperature ranges we find.
Signs of a collapse in the subpolar gyre include a decline in sea surface and surface air temperatures. Now, how is that possible in a time of relatively rapid global warming?
It's quite a unique location where there is a so-called warming hole, where there is very little warming or even cooling. And it has to do with the function of this AMOC of heat transport. If the subpolar gyre shuts down, or if the AMOC starts to slow down, there is less heat transport towards the north. There's a lot of cold water coming in from the northern side, so you get locally cooling down of the area. So this is the area, let's say, below Greenland. And this can fully offset, or at least partially offset, global warming.
Why is permafrost thaw considered a possible regional tipping element, but not a global one?
Yeah, this is an interesting system. So permafrost is frozen ground that is permanently frozen. It occurs in the northern hemisphere, so around Canada, but also a lot in Siberia. One reason that we see this as a more regional tipping element is because if locally the permafrost thaws, you might get some type of feedback of increasing temperatures that might also tell the surrounding permafrost. But it's quite difficult to actually translate, to move around to other parts of the globe. Moreover, part of the permafrost is on different latitudes, so some is more polar than others, which means they're also exposed to different temperatures. This together leads to that you fill in lots of localized places where you find abrupt thawing in some models, but you would not find this if you look globally. If you look globally at permafrost thaw, you would see a quite gradual decline.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Dutch scientist Sjoerd Terpstra about abrupt climate change, a very serious subject. After investigating models and narrowing down to those that do include vegetation, your team doesn't seem to find a good basis to evaluate abrupt shifts in the Amazon or boreal forests. Now, these are well-known concerns with the global public. Why did you feel you had to leave them out, so to speak?
Yeah, this really has to do with the limits of the methodology. So we're indeed aware that these systems are at risk for quite abrupt disappearance. However, with the edge detection method we are using, we're not able to capture changes in vegetation as well as in other systems. And that's because these variables, these land variables, like vegetation, leaf cover, they behave a little bit different than some others. And this makes it challenging to detect shifts in them. However, we do know that in this same set of models, in the same set of experiments, they actually do occur. So we find a few of them, but also there's another study from Pari and others in 2022 where they explicitly only looked at this Amazon rainforest. And there they did find that out of the set of models that represent vegetation well, that the majority, around 90%, 80-90%, show abrupt disappearance of part of the Amazon. And this goes from around 0 to 40%, depending on which model you're looking at.
One of the biggest fears for over a billion people in Africa and India would be if the monsoon rains watering their agriculture were to stop. Is that possible, and what did your new assessment find?
Yeah, changes in the monsoon could have quite severe impacts. In the CMF6 data, we do not really find any abrupt changes in the monsoon. There's only one example in one model where we find a slight northward shift of the Indian summer monsoon, but it's only one out of the 57 models, so we don't find any strong evidence for this. Also, we have quite strict criteria of what we would call abrupt. And we do know that monsoons might change with climate, although it's, I think, still a little bit unclear in what way. But we do not find the same type of shift as we do see in some other systems.
The 2023 Global Tipping Points report from Tim Lenton and his colleagues said it was unclear whether Antarctic sea ice goes through abrupt shifts. Now, I find that hard to believe because the southern sea ice experienced an abrupt decline starting around 2015 and taking less than 5 years. We just talked to experts like Edward Doddridge about that. Isn't that an abrupt shift?
Part of this is indeed definition. What would you call a big enough area of sea ice disappearing? Enough of an event to really call it an abrupt shift. But at the same time, there is still quite a lot of discussion and uncertainty surrounding whether Antarctic sea ice is either a tipping element or whether it can undergo abrupt shifts or not. What I can say is that in the CM6 models that we do find some of these shifts in a certain set of models, we find around 11 out of 57 models that have some abrupt shifts in Antarctic sea ice. The interesting thing here is that it's quite dependent where you look at around Antarctica. So there's not any single event that we detect in any of the models where the sea ice all around Antarctica disappears in one go. We do mainly find two locations where it locally disappears. One is in the southern Atlantic section, and the other one is more on the Pacific side of the Antarctic continent. And there we do find quite large-scale abrupt shifts.
Your new paper does not predict the year or even the decade when an abrupt shift will take place. Why not? And what gauge did you use?
This is because we used a scenario where we increased the CO2 by 1%, which is way more rapid than we're currently emitting CO2. So we could not use the year of simulations as an accurate prediction of a year or an accurate assessment of the year in which the shift happens. That's why we linked them to the global temperature they occurred at. So we looked for each abrupt shift, what is now the global warming in this model compared to pre-industrial. And that way we can still make an assessment of what future climate you would potentially get such a shift. In the meantime, there are some other assessments looking at more realistic scenarios. These are called SSP scenarios, and they make use of the historic emissions and predicted future emissions based on expected emissions. And there they find similar results as we do with abrupt changes in, for example, the sea ice.
With 57 different climate models running, each with their own data and operating assumptions, how many agreed that abrupt shifts in climate will happen and become more likely as we overheat the planet?
So we find that in 48 models, we find at least one abrupt shift, and in 44 models out of 57, we find even more than one. So this does show that these models are capable of creating abrupt shifts in the climate and that it becomes more likely as we continue the warming. Some of these shifts happen at relatively high temperatures, up to 3 to 5 degrees of global warming, but we already see a risk around 1 to 1.5 degree that in some systems and in some models, we can already see abrupt shifts occurring.
How can we use information about abrupt shifts, and how does this research move forward towards better and better predictions?
So what this research adds is that we look at the newest set of climate models, the CMIP-6. This type of assessment has also been done on the previous generation of models. And this way we can partially compare of what the models do now, but we can also show that these models are capable of this abrupt shift, and that it's a risk that we should take seriously. Now, we did quite a general overview, so we didn't delve specific in each system with all the mechanisms of this shift happening. So hopefully this also informs other research where they can more explicitly look into the specific feedbacks that are happening and what the real likelihood is. And on the other hand, it also signals that it's important that we take into account that this could happen, right? It doesn't show that it will happen, but that it could happen. So in some places in the world especially, it could be important to take this into account when planning future climate scenarios. The likelihood is really difficult to pin down, but especially on a regional scale, right, if you look at about single continents or part of continents, this can have quite severe effects on top of the expected climate change. And I think this also calls, like so many other studies, for the importance of cutting emissions and halting climate change before we get into more and more risky areas.
From the University of Utrecht, we've been speaking with climate scientist Sjoerd Terpstra. He led the new paper, Assessment of Abrupt Shifts in CMIP-6 Models Using Edge Detection. It was published June 23rd, 2025. Find links to all the news and science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. We are out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening.